Booster.
Go.
Retro.
Go.
Vital.
We're go fly.
Guidance.
Guidance go.
Procedures.
Go.
Capcom.
We're go fly.
Launch control, this is Houston. We are go for launch.
This is Space Talk, a weekly program that highlights America's space program and what's new in the space flight from around the globe. And now, with the past, present, and future of space exploration, here is Jim Behnke.
And good afternoon, everyone, on this Memorial Day weekend from Florida's Space Coast, home of the most skilled aerospace workforce in America. I'm Jim Behnke, and this is the May 29th edition of 2010 of Space Talk, brought to you by United Space Alliance. Innovation you can trust, performance you can count on. Well, we're going to get to the news, updates, and other stuff that you need to know later in the program. But in the meantime, we're going to start talking about what's happening at the Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex next weekend, and that is the U.S. Astronaut Hall of Fame induction ceremony. We have four new astronauts getting inducted into that Hall of Fame next week, and we hope to be joined by one of them shortly. But in the meantime, let me talk about all four of them. Next week, we're going to be having Catherine Thornton, Ken Bowersox, Frank Culbertson, and Guy Bluford joining the ranks of others who have been voted in to the Hall of Fame. In the interest of full disclosure, I want you to know that I am a part of that committee that helps vote in the people from year to year. We get our ballots and get to mark up who we think should be in, and there's an elaborate scoring system. Our good friend and former launch director Bob Seek heads that up every year and done another fine job in balloting and tallying all of the votes this year. And again, the four winners, Kathy Thornton, Ken Bowersox, Frank Culbertson, and Guy Bluford. And again, we're hoping to be joined by Guy here within the next few minutes as we wait for his phone call and our folks go scrambling to get a hold of his handler to make sure that that he calls in on time. Well, let me talk about these other astronauts too, because we want to give everybody kind of full exposure to you and let you know who these people are. Catherine Thornton flew four space shuttle missions during her 12 years in the astronaut office. One of them, a Department of Defense flight in November of 1989. What is going to be her famous flight, STS-49, in May of 1992. That was the flight of Endeavour's maiden launch. Great mission. Would have been my mission, was supposed to have been my mission. I was a reporter at Florida Today then, and I studied up for that flight. They were going to go up and rescue a communications satellite, and I went to Houston for all the pre-launch preparations, interviewed all the astronauts, got smart on the whole thing. But at the same time they're getting ready to launch, the family was getting to launch our third son, Alex. And wouldn't you know it, just before they launched, Alex was born. And so I spent my time watching the spacewalks, and my good friend and colleague Todd Halverson covering that mission while I was in the recovery rooms and whatnot at the hospital, dealing with Alex's birth. And coincidentally, now here we are talking about her going into the Hall of Fame. He just graduated from high school, and we're celebrating his open house this weekend as he's off to UCF. So that's been 18 years since then. Kathy Thornton was great because. That was the flight that, and she worked the robot arm for this, that they took three spacewalkers out to go grab the satellite. The way they had figured out how to do it didn't work. And so they had to literally scratch on the back of the flight plan and figure out what was going on. And they figured out a way in the crew cabin. Dan Brandenstein figured out with his crew how they could go out there with three guys. And it's the only time we've ever had three spacewalkers on a spacewalk. And so between the three spacewalkers and her running the robot arm, they were able to grab this satellite and haul it in. And that experience worked out well for her, because then years later, in 1993, she was part of the first crew that got to do the Hubble Space Telescope repair missions. And so she was actually on two of the five spacewalks. And in one of the spacewalks, they tried to reel up the solar array, and it didn't work. It was jammed. It was budged. They couldn't roll it up to bring it back to Earth, and they were going to replace it with new ones. And so there's these famous pictures of her at the end of a robot arm taking this big giant solar wing and just hauling it as hard as she could and throwing it away, throwing it overboard, basically, into orbit around the Earth. And, of course, it came back and burned up a little bit later. So very experienced astronaut, and again, a great representative to be in the Hall of Fame. Ken Bowersox, man, five-time shuttle astronaut. Ken's famous for a lot of different things. They call him Sox. That's his nickname, Bowersox. Sox has done a lot of great missions, was also part of that Hubble Space Telescope mission as a pilot in December of 93, went on later to command several flights, spent 5.5 months on board the International Space Station. In fact, was on board the space station when the Columbia disaster happened, and he went up on a shuttle, expecting to come back on a shuttle, and actually had to return to Earth on a Soyuz spacecraft. And Sox, of all the great things he's done for the astronaut office and is continuing to do now with SpaceX, kind of as their astronaut in the office to deal with future issues of SpaceX taking people to the space station. Sox was on Home Improvement twice and with Tim Allen when the show was on ABC. And boy, did everyone have fun with that. And he had fun with it. And it was a great thing for the crew to do. And his dry look, his straight man look against Tim Allen was just absolutely priceless. And like I say, he's done a lot of great things for the space program. But I'll tell you, I'll never forget those episodes. Frank Culberson, the third of the gang to join the Hall of Fame this week, joined the astronaut office in May of 1984, flew three shuttle missions. And really between every flight that he did, and all were important flights, he also was very involved in management, very involved in fact, was in charge of the shuttle Mir program, was put in charge of that, and got that early experience that we needed so badly for the astronauts to get to know how to work with the Russians, to get to understand how space station operations work. Those were the days when we first started realizing and started hearing these quotes about how shuttle missions were a sprint and the Russian space station missions were a marathon. And there was two very different cultures, not only politically, not only nationalistically, but operationally in terms of spaceflight, how you do things and how you plan things and how you prepare things. Every little moment of a space shuttle mission choreographed and planned and scripted out. And the space station, it's like, hey, here's 10 things we want you to do over the next week. Get them done when you can. Very different way of doing things. Frank was able to help bridge that cultural gap and went on to do some great things with the space program. Frank's also famous for being the one on the International Space Station when the 9-1-1 happened, when the attacks on New York and Washington happened, the plane crash in Pennsylvania. And he was able to see those things unfold from his point in space. I mean, the space station basically flew right over New York City when the two towers were hit. And he could see that smoke and that plume. And there's some very famous pictures of that. And his words as being the only American in space to see that and to be kind of separated from everything as he watched it happen. I remember him talking about how, you know, right after that incident, they grounded all of the airplanes. They grounded all the airliners. And you could see that from space that had happened because there were no contrails over the United States. So, something they were totally normal for seeing and totally normal for dealing with. But nothing there, nothing there. And it's just a profound situation for Frank. And he had a lot of great words to say about it. I'm seeing now we're gonna take a little break here in just a moment, our little 2-minute break. And when we come back, we do have now lined up with us Dr. Guy Bluford. And when we come back from this break, we'll formally introduce him and bring him on and see if he can't stick around a little bit longer for us as we move on. So, again, thanks for being with us today on Space Talk on Memorial Day weekend. We're going to take a break. Be right back. Space Talk brought to you by United Space Alliance. And I'm Jim Banky, and you are listening to WMMB.
Now, back to our own mission specialist, Jim Banky.
And good afternoon, everybody. Again, on Memorial Day weekend from Florida Space Coast, I am Jim Banky. You're listening to Space Talk brought to you by United Space Alliance. And I am honored to welcome to the program today one of the four inductees who are going into our U.S. Astronaut Hall of Fame next weekend in ceremonies at the Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex. We talked about Katherine Thornton, Ken Bowersox, and Frank Culbertson at the beginning of the hour, but now I'm honored to welcome Colonel Guy Bluford, retired Air Force Colonel, 144 combat missions over Southeast Asia, flew four space shuttle missions during a 15-year career with NASA. Guy is a member of the original 1978 class of space shuttle astronauts, was the flight engineer for the very first night launch and night landing of a space shuttle back in 1983. Participated as a mission specialist during the first dedicated German Space Lab mission during a classified DOD flight, and as well as a DOD flight filled with experiments for the Strategic Defense Initiative Office. All that, plus the fact that Dr. Bluford will go into the history books as the first African-American to fly in space, and all of that has earned him in a place in the U.S. Astronaut Hall of Fame. And now Dr. Guy Bluford joins us on the phone. Dr. Bluford, welcome and congratulations.
Thank you. It's good to be good to join you.
Good to talk to you again, sir. Dr. Bluford and I worked together on the Space Foundation when I was a vice president there a few years ago, and he continues to serve on the board. And it's just, boy, you've got the whole package, sir. I mean, you've had a great career, a great experience in the astronaut office. You continue to do a lot of good work. Now, and I guess what I'm wondering about right now is the Hall of Fame. You're coming here to be inducted. How big of a deal is that to you? What's that like?
Well, I'm excited to come down there to be part of that and to really meet a whole lot of old astronauts that I hadn't seen in a while. So I'm looking forward to it. It should be an exciting affair.
Is it something that, you know, when a rookie starts out in the NFL, you know, right away he's thinking Hall of Fame. Can he have a Hall of Fame career? You know, do you think, is this something that that's on the top of anyone's minds in the astronaut office, either then or now? Is this something you guys ever talk about or think about?
I think maybe some do. I really hadn't put a lot of thought into it, but it really is an honor to be recognized in that way. And I'm pretty sure there are a lot of astronauts who yearn to be eventually in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, and of course... all of the guys from Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo have all been inducted, and then when the shuttle era started, they realized that you couldn't just wholesale start dumping everybody on. You'd have to put kind of a limit onto it at some point, and so it's taken three or four people a year to work through the various things, and I guess we have more than 300 or so prospects, so it each year to me it becomes a bigger deal to be inducted in a more special honor as sort of the field is narrowed down as to who's the cream of the crop. And again, Dr. Bluford, also, you know, the importance of you being the first African American in space, talk a little bit about that, put that in perspective. It seems to me that was a huge deal back then. Is it still a big deal today, or is it just a trivia thing?
Well, I know it was a big deal when I did it in 83, and because I opened the door for other African-Americans to come into space. But it still is somewhat of a big deal. We do have other African-Americans who've flown, but yet the pool of African-Americans is still very small. But I feel very honored to be in that role.
That's still a tough deal. You talk about the pool of astronauts. You came into the astronaut experience with a great deal of flight training, military experience. You were qualified. The number of qualified astronauts, the number of qualified people in the African-American community is still something I think you are working on. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, that's very true. I mean, the number of African-Americans who are in the science and engineering field really is still much too low, and as well as the number of African-Americans who are pilots in the Air Force are really pretty low. So I tend to work on that particular problem to try and encourage more people to consider you know, science and engineering and flying as a career among the African-Americans.
Yeah, and I know Leland Melvin was kind of my current-day hero on all of that, to have his story of going from the NFL to flying in space is pretty special. Well, let's talk about your history with the astronaut office. Now, when you came in at in the class of 78, that was the first space shuttle class, the first class to come in since the Apollo days, and the one that was really gonna feed the shuttle program for years to come. And nothing had been figured out yet. You guys were in on the ground floor. Talk about what those days were like, and some of the issues you had to put up with and figure out to make it work.
Well, it was really very interesting because we were still developing the shuttle. And so when we came in 78, they were doing approach and landing tests on the shuttle. They were still working on the engines on the shuttle. We had not flown the shuttle, so still we were learning quite a bit about the shuttle. And for us coming in, we had to learn all the things associated with the shuttle as well as flying in space. And so the training program was still rudimentary as we went through the program, and it has improved considerably. But it was quite a challenge initially because you know, the astronaut program hadn't trained astronauts in almost 10 years.
Mm-hmm. And so you didn't know where to start, or you didn't know. I mean, you didn't have procedures in place, and yet you didn't even have hardware really figured out yet till quite toward the end.
Well, we had some shuttle simulators, so we had that. But we were still developing procedures to fly the shuttle because we hadn't flown the shuttle at the time. Mm-hmm. And there really wasn't a program to train astronauts, at least a full-fledged program. There were some people who trained us, but there wasn't a smooth training program for astronauts. So we picked up things along the way by supporting what was going on in the astronaut office, getting briefings by engineers who are currently working the various shuttle systems, and it has smoothed out considerably after that.
Now, back then, I recall from reading, you know, Gemini and Apollo, the guys were given very specific engineering responsibilities. And you know, Mike Collins, I know, writing and Carrying the Fire, was talking about he was part of the extravehicular mobility suits, the spacewalking suits, and went and figured all those out before they would go fly. Did you have similar technical assignments that you all had to figure out and become experts on one particular system and put your input into that?
Well, we were all farmed out to various support areas in the astronaut program after we went through the initial training. When we showed up, they had anticipated that we would require 2 years of training, but after the end of the first year, they felt that we were qualified enough to support the activities in the astronaut office, and people were farmed out to various projects and systems to help support what was going on as we were getting ready to fly for the first time.
So then as the flights began, talk about STS-1. What were you doing, and what was that like, that whole experience like for you?
It was a fabulous experience for me. I was at Edwards Air Force Base when STS-1 landed. So that was really quite exciting to see it come in and land on the lake bed.
Did you have to hold John Young down from getting back in and launching again?
I'm pretty sure he was anxious to get back in. But I think for me, as well as for the other astronauts, we were excited about the fact that, hey, this vehicle actually flies, and, hey, we really got an exciting vehicle ahead of us.
Uh-huh.
So I think we were all excited when Columbia came in, and Crip and John did an excellent job on the first flight.
And then, so 6 flights later, STS-7, Sally Ride gets to go up and be the first female American female in space. And then a flight later, you get to go up, and not only do you get to go up, but you get to go up at night and come back at night.
Right, and that was really pretty exciting. I flew with Dick Trulli and Dan Brandenstine. We hadn't flown the shuttle at night, and we had a mission where we had to fly the shuttle at night. So the team had to develop procedures for flying at night and landing at night, and there were some unique features that we had to solve, but that worked out very nice. It was an exciting flight, lifting off at 2:30 in the morning and landing at the Cape a little after midnight.
Yeah, and with the floodlights, I remember how lit up the coast was, it seemed, when we all finally got an idea of how bright those lights are at the shuttle runway. That was something else.
Right.
You also, and this is totally trivia, but you also were the source of to what to me is still the greatest unofficial shuttle launch patch that ever exists in the history of the program. And you know the one I'm talking about.
Right, right.
with your eyes and your faces at a night launch and looking a little I don't know what, not scared, but
I think we were just awe-inspired.
Awe-inspired.
and that really was a nifty patch. Dick Truly developed the patch, and it sort of showed Dick Truly as a veteran had done this before. And then he had four rookies who were all looking out the other window in eyes, aghast.
Bug-eyed, yeah.
Yeah, as we flew at night.
That was great. Guys, stand by for us, would you? We're going to take our built-in five-minute hold here at the bottom of the hour, get caught up on news, weather, and sports, and then we'll come back with some more questions and some more commentary about past, present, and future shuttle with Dr. Guy Bluford, who's going to be inducted in the Hall of Fame next weekend. So stand by. This is Space Talk, brought to you by United Space Alliance. I'm Jim Banky, and you're listening to WMMB.
Now, back to our own mission specialist, Jim Banky.
And welcome back to our second half of Space Talk, brought to you by United Space Alliance. Innovation you can trust, performance you can count on. Sorry we didn't get to mention this earlier, but you are still welcome to give us a call. 321-768-1240, the number to call to join me today with your questions or comments, or send us email to spacetalking@aol.com as we continue our conversation with NASA astronaut, former NASA astronaut, Dr. Guy Bluford, one of four to be inducted into the U.S. Astronaut Hall of Fame next weekend at the Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex. And Dr. Bluford, thanks for hanging around with us. Now, I wanted to ask you this question because as I was going over your bio, I had never really seen this and thought of it in this way, but you are a doctor because you earned your Ph.D. in 1978 from the Air Force Institute of Technology, where you earned a Doctor of Philosophy in Aerospace Engineering. And I was really struck by that. How do you combine, you read it that way, it's like, how do you combine, studying Plato with designing new spacecraft or whatever it is? What's the philosophy of aerospace engineering?
Well, it's interesting. I don't think there's Plato involved in it. It was just a lot more understanding of aerospace engineering. I went to the Air Force Institute of Technology to get a master's degree, and not only stayed on for a master's degree, but stayed on for a Ph.D., which required a lot more study in understanding aerodynamics and some of the aspects of flying airplanes.
So a doctor of philosophy in engineering is the philosophy behind it, the thoughts behind it, the rationale behind it, but not so much am I there or do I exist?
Right, right. I totally agree with you on that.
If I bend a metal, did it bend, or if I don't, I won't get into it.
Right.
That's great. Okay, so we're talking about your first, you did STS-8, you did another flight, and then, of course, Challenger happened. Major turning point in the history of really everything that has to do with the space program, and it still ripples to this day. Flying twice before, flying twice after, other than the obvious differences that you were wearing the orange suits and had some other procedures in place, how was it different in the astronaut office? What was it like to be an astronaut before and after?
Well, I think before it was still a new vehicle. We were still learning how to fly it, but we were starting to get comfortable in the operation of the vehicle. I think STS-51L was like number 25, or maybe the 25th launch. So we were starting to get pretty comfortable in it without recognizing the fact that it still is an experimental vehicle. So I think we were all very surprised that the accident occurred. And I think after the accident, we realized that, hey, we had to recognize that this was an experimental vehicle and that we had to treated as such versus sort of a airline sort of vehicle.
And by the time, of course, Columbia had happened, you had long left the Corps, but But did you, were those thoughts immediately come back to you when that happened?
To some extent. I think the thing that bothered me the most in the Columbia accident was the fact that we made the same mistake twice, which is normalization. It's called normalization of deviation.
Right.
We saw something that was wrong, but we got used to it, and we ignored it, and it jumped up and bit us. So I was very concerned about the fact that we seemingly made the same mistake twice with reference to flying this vehicle.
Wow. And now, of course, we face the end of the shuttle program, brought Atlantis home this week for what could have been its last landing. What are your thoughts now of this vehicle that was so much a part of your life, this program coming to a conclusion?
Well, I'm sort of disappointed. I recognize, too, that it is time to shut down the shuttle. The shuttle has been flying since 1981, so we've been flying an awful long time, and it's really time to move forward and do other things in the space program. Hopefully, we'll develop other ways of flying in space, and we'll be flying more astronauts in the future in different spacecraft.
And do you want to be more specific than that in terms of your hopes for the future? Seems to be, which side are you on if you're a former astronaut?
Well, it's interesting. I can't be any more specific than that because I really don't know that much what's really going on the inside. But
yeah.
I am hopeful that we will develop other vehicles to replace the shuttle and continue to fly in space.
Tell us a little bit as we wrap up our conversation with you. What are you up to these days? What's your life like, and what are you doing?
Well, I'm currently in Cleveland, Ohio. I do a little engineering consulting. I do speaking engagements. I still enjoy doing speaking engagements, and I also serve on a couple of boards. So I'm still busy to some extent. I try and stay in the aerospace business, stay involved with what's going on, but yet on the other hand, I'm sort of semi-retired.
And semi-retired. And of course, we know that means you're probably busier than ever.
Right.
That's great. Dr. Guy Bluford, thanks for spending some time with us today, and it's good to talk to you again. And perhaps we'll see you next weekend at the induction ceremony.
And I'm looking forward to it.
Very good, sir. Well, thanks very much for your time. We'll say so long to you. And again, that Astronaut Hall of Fame induction ceremony is next weekend at the Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex. And just because I'm this kind of guy, we have invited Andrea Farmer to be on the show with us today. And Andrea, out of the graciousness of her heart, is taking about 10 minutes away from her sunning activity duties on the west coast of Florida. Is calling in from the hotel room. Andrea, how are you today?
Hey, Jim, I'm great, and I would much rather be talking to you about all things space than getting a little fun and sun.
Well, maybe we could do a little bit of both yet today, shall we? Just want something.
Exactly.
I want a drink with an umbrella.
Well, thanks for all you do. We really do appreciate it.
Well, we appreciate you. And now tell us really quick then, you know, we talked to Guy, the Hall of Fame induction ceremony is next weekend. How can people plug in to this ceremony, this celebration? What can they see? Where do they got to go?
It's all happening on Saturday, June 5th, and we've got the induction ceremony that's happening at 2:30, and that's where all four of our inductees, Guy Bluford, Ken Bowersox, Frank Cooperson, and Catherine Thornton are going to be inducted. And there is, it's such a cool ceremony, too. The red carpet, if you will, the launch of all of the astronauts. We expect more than 25 astronauts at the induction ceremony.
Wow.
And it's so much fun as they walk down the red carpet, being introduced, waving to everyone that's gathered around to see this induction ceremony. That in and of itself is amazing. And then the actual induction. You're watching history in the making as we increase the ranks of those in the Hall of Fame to 77 people.
Wow, I didn't know it was that high already. Wow.
Yeah, it's getting there.
So
then there's also a few seats still available for a morning bus tour.
Okay.
And your guide will be either Buzz Aldrin, Charlie Duke, Jack Lusma, or Pinky Nelson.
Wow, really?
Pretty cool if you can tour Kennedy Space Center with one of these astronauts.
One of those guys. Now, is this a deal where you head up to the visitor complex, first come, first serve? Is there reservations online? How do you do this?
I would recommend if you're interested in the bus tour, go ahead and go online and make those reservations now because we're almost at capacity. But to see the induction ceremony that's included on Saturday at 2:30, that's included with regular admission to the visitor complex.
And is the ceremony outdoors like in the shuttle plaza or are you taking people over to the Saturn V Center?
It is outdoors underneath. It's covered area, but right there in NASA Central, where when you first walk into the visitor complex.
And we will hope for the storms to hold off for a little bit.
Each weather forecast is looking good, and we if for some reason stormy weather was predicted, we will move inside and go to the Apollo Saturn V Center.
Okay, very good. Now this, of course, kicks off for you a very busy summer. We've just got a couple of minutes left here. Tell us real quick about what other things are going on, and talk to me about Star Trek.
Oh, absolutely. Star Trek Live begins on June 11th, and this is a really cool show to have. It's actually the national world premiere of this interactive show that Mad Science has put together under a CBS license. So it's going to incorporate some of your favorite moments of Star Trek, but also bringing it, looking at the past, present, and future of space flight. It's neat in that it all begins. You're drafted as a guest. You're drafted into Starfleet Academy. So there you are in the thick of things, and you face some great challenges and challenges of modern day space travel as an unwelcome Romulan enters the scene and is heading to Earth. So there's a lot of excitement and a lot of interaction.
And I hope not any Romulan ale, because it could get real nasty really quick. Well, and with another minute here, Andrea, talk about other things going on. The Hubble 3D IMAX theater thing is still happening, right?
Yes, that just started in March. And if you haven't seen Hubble, the Hubble Space Telescope 3D movie, it is amazing in the IMAX theater. You feel like you're being transported to different galaxies and exploring all these great celestial surroundings thanks to the Hubble Space Telescope, perhaps the greatest telescope ever built. Well, next to Galileo.
Really.
You also are plugged into the last space shuttle mission that traveled up to the space telescope to give it its final repairs. So you feel like you're walking alongside the astronauts of STS-125 doing the repairs. So it's a neat perspective.
Well, and with 30 seconds, talk about you've got some kind of a neat sphere out there now that's a projection sphere of some kind.
Right at the Astronaut Hall of Fame, which is included in regular admission to the visitor complex, you can see Science on a Sphere, and it has some really neat looks at Earth. You feel like you're looking at Earth from space. You're looking at other planets in our solar system, and we tell some great stories there with Science on a Sphere. Lots of different programs that we have for that to show you different aspects of what's going on here on Earth and out in the universe.
Okay, give us the website, Kennedy Space Center.
www.kennedyspacecenter.com.
It's as easy as that.
Yes.
Good. Andrea, thank you so much. Okay, go back to the sun, all right?
All right, thank you.
Sunscreen.
Enjoy.
Drinks with umbrellas in them. That's the way this weekend should be. Okay, we're going to be back with our final segment and wrap up with some news and updates and whatnot. We'll be right back. This is Jim Banky, Space Talk on WMMB.
This is Space Talk with Jim Banky.
And again, welcome back as we begin our final segment of today's Space Talk, sponsored by United Space Alliance. Innovation you can trust, performance you can count on. Well, we're just you and me for the remaining parts of this show today. We invite you to give us a call if you want with a little question or comment, 321-768-1240, or send me an email real quick to spacetalking@AOL.com, and we'll be happy to take your questions and comments here. In the meantime, let's go through the proverbial stack of stuff and get you caught up on some things that have happened this week with a little bit of commentary. Shuttle Atlantis landed on its first landing attempt, believe it or not, on Wednesday. It's been a long time since that's happened. If this does turn out to be its last flight, then it surely did end in style. 294 total days in space, 4,648 orbits of the Earth, 120 million miles traveled in 32 flights over the course of the last 15 years or so. And I will admit to you that as we were watching Atlantis come in on NASA TV, and there was the one long-range tracking camera, just beautiful shots, I did have the little inklings of a tear and a little bit of a choked-up feeling starting to well up from within side. This could have been the last time we see that vehicle fly. And so many people, rightly so, focus and concentrate on the people that are flying, the astronauts and the people behind the program, and that's absolutely 100% acceptable and right and appropriate. But, you know, one of the reasons that when we moved down from Minnesota to Florida to be a part of the space program, one reason why we moved here instead of, let's say, to Houston or even to, let's say, Pasadena, where the Jet Propulsion Laboratory is, or even, you know, Washington, where really all the policy is, and I'm that's something that I appreciate being a part of. I wanted to be near the hardware. I wanted to be by the flight hardware. I wanted to be where the fire fills the flame trench, and that's always been my desire to be a part of that. So we came here. The point of that being that, you know, you get close to the hardware, and the guys that work out at the Cape will tell you this is as important as the people are to everything, and as important as safety and worrying about the astronauts is absolutely key, fundamental to the process that goes on out there. That you become close to the hardware. You become attached to these inanimate vehicles. You know, when we lost Challenger and when we lost Columbia, you know, as much as we mourned the loss of the crew and felt for the families and how it impacted all of us at a very, you know, gut, emotional, visceral level, you know, missing those spacecraft. I mean, to this day, I miss Challenger. To this day, when I look at a model of Columbia, you know, I think, you know, where is it? It's gone. It's stored on a shelf in the vehicle assembly building. You know, I miss that hardware. And in that same kind of sentiment, you know, starting to fill me up now about Atlantis, Endeavor, and Discovery. You know, these are living vehicles to us that work here, that work on these ships. And as they begin the end of their lifetime, as they begin the end of their useful time flying, you know, to the chance that Atlantis was the last time we'll see it in the sky means something. And this is the kind of, I don't know if it's a grieving process. I don't know what you would call it, psychologically. But whatever it is, it started. And it's become real. And it's going to be tough during these next few flights. Now, was this Atlantis' last flight? Don't know for sure. Again, to just review the thinking on that is that when Discovery, or I guess it's Endeavor, when Endeavor flies its final mission, whether it be late this fall, November time frame, or gets bumped to early next year, the thinking is that they'll have Atlantis ready to fly with an external tank and a set of solid rocket boosters for the emergency rescue flight. And if that flight does not happen for any reason, which, of course, we certainly hope it does not happen, you would have a complete space shuttle stack available to you to use. And there are ways to fly that mission and still not have the rescue capability of another orbiter to get the crew back. At the very basic, you would start with a minimum of four crew on board and bring up a load of supplies and fly it. So they're working that. They're looking at that. Senator Nelson's talking very hard about it, trying to find ways to put money in the budget for it should it become an opportunity. And I'm feeling pretty optimistic on it. I bet you anything they find a way and a reason and a rationale to fly Atlantis one more time. So that little tear that started had that, you know, that other thought going in the back of my head that this might not be it. But I'll tell you, when Discovery flies again here in when is it going to be now? September, and you know that's its last flight. Put it on the 747 and take it up to the Air and Space Museum. You know when it's done. So and then Endeavor will fly, and I remain confident that when Endeavor's mission is done and it's safe, it's going to remain here at the Kennedy Space Center to be put on display. And then when Atlantis does its final thing, whatever the end of that story turns out to be, it will be sent somewhere yet to be determined. So we're going to watch for those words here this summer. By the way, also, as we're nearing the end here, I want to congratulate the folks of the Air Force, the United Launch Alliance, for getting that Delta IV off the ground Thursday night. It was a long week and several launch attempts to make that happen, some late-night shifts and some all-nighters by some folks. But it got off the ground safely. It successfully delivered the Global Positioning System satellite into orbit, and you saw once again how even on the commercial side, you know, they're going to launch when they're ready to launch and not a moment too soon. And I think that as you continue to watch the fireworks happen in Washington over the future of our space program, and there's all this rhetoric about whether or not the commercial industry can handle our manned space program and even our ability to launch cargo. You know, whether or not anything else works and anything else happens, you see in the Delta IV anyway and in the Atlas V, proof that that our industry knows what it's doing and knows how to make those things happen. So again, congratulations to the Delta IV team. A quick correction: I mentioned the water deluge system last weekend, as it looked like it had triggered. And in fact, I learned this week that there's no water deluge system at Pad 37. I was seeing vapor coming off from the from liquid oxygen boiling off after the launch attempt had scrubbed at the last few seconds. And so I was fooled by what I saw on television. And it's neat to know that even after, several years of Delta IV operations, it's fun to learn some new things about that vehicle. So just wanted to be upfront with you about that. Finally, as we're looking at Memorial Day weekend, it marks the beginning of summer. Gives us a nice three-day weekend to take a break. But it's also fitting to recall what this holiday is supposed to be about, and that's about those who have sacrificed their all for what we do. And that's true in the military world. It's also true in the space program. We've had astronauts that have given their lives, and we've had a lot of engineers and technicians who have given their lives in various ways, accidents and test mishaps and whatnot. And we remember all of them and say thank you to them and wish God's blessings on them and their families as we remember during the Memorial Day weekend all that has come before us. Well, that's it for today. Thanks for listening. Space Talk, sponsored by United Space Alliance, and is a production of Mylas Solutions. Aaron Michaels is my personal chief engineer. I'm Jim Bankey. We'll talk to you again real soon. Now, don't go anywhere. The Home Mortgage Law Show is next, followed by Don Conroy at 4 p.m. right here on WMMB.